So I want to share something from John 15, but I found myself being taken back to Jeremiah 17 because of what a close connection it is. And this is these verses that meant so much to Nancy, and which she put up on the wall and memorized and several times has in her journals. Going back to verse 5 of Jeremiah 17, first it's cursed, or to make it sound like blessed, we'll say cursed, is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength, whose heart turns away from Yahweh. So it's synonymous. If you're trusting in man, then your heart is turning away from Yahweh. You cannot trust in both. You cannot serve both God and money, mammon, any false god. It's exclusive. So if people and the opinions of people are primary in your life rather than the opinion of God, and God's opinion is synonymous with truth, because he's always right. But then it says, that man who trusts in man, not in Yahweh, is like a shrub in the desert. He shall not see any good come. He shall dwell in the parched places of the wilderness, in an uninhabited salt land. I mean, what a picture. Alone, uninhabited. You are going to be alone. Now, you can go the whole way the world goes, and you're not, and you feel like you're surrounded by people, but you're alone because you're cut off from who you're intended to be. You're not in a relationship with Yahweh, the giver of life. And then blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord. So you've got the curse and now you have the blessing. And by the way, this word is not the Hebrew word Asher, which is translated blessed, but should be translated happy. This is Baruch, which should be translated blessed. And it really means blessed in the sense of receiving the blessings of God. You are a blessed person. Blessed is the man who trusts in Yahweh. And then it says, it's like, that wasn't enough to say that, because then he rephrases it, whose trust is Yahweh. So you're trusting in Yahweh, and your trust itself is Yahweh. It's almost like, don't separate it, like I'm going to trust in him. It's like, he is my trust. And even though in a sense it's the same thing, it's not exactly. It just has a power to it. So blessed is the man who trusts in Yahweh, whose trust is in Yahweh. He is like a tree planted by water. And this is what Nancy loved so much. He is like a tree planted by water that sends out its roots by the stream and does not fear when heat comes. And she turned to this passage very early in her little over four years battling cancer, shortly after she was diagnosed. And she said, I want to be like the tree planted by the water that trusts in God and that sends out its roots by the stream and does not fear when heat comes. So the other one is the parched places of the wilderness, but that's all he's experiencing, and it truly is parched, and he doesn't have a recourse, or at least one that he's pursuing, that can refresh him like we do, you know, tree planted by water that sends its roots by the stream. So we actually are given a choice of where to plant ourselves, and in a sense, the person who trusts in man is given a choice also. The reason he's out in that barren, parched places of the wilderness in an uninhabited salt land is because he's choosing to trust in man. So by choosing to trust in God, trusting in Yahweh, we can effectively choose where we're planted. So we're the tree, and we can plant ourselves by the water, with God's empowerment, of course, that sends out its roots by the stream and does not fear when heat comes. And heat's going to come. It's not if heat comes. It's when heat comes. For its leaves remain green, and it is not anxious in the year of drought. Now, you don't usually think of trees being anxious, but obviously in the analogy, we're the tree, and we are anxious. So, and is not anxious in the year of drought. Year of drought will come, but you don't have to be anxious. It's so different than prosperity theology. It's so different than God will keep those bad things from happening to you. No, bad things will happen to you, but you will be a person who is trusting in Yahweh, and He is your source of strength and refreshment. And is not anxious in the year of drought, for it does not cease to bear fruit. And for me to be able to say to Nancy in her final days on this earth under the curse, you have borne fruit. God has really done what you prayed that He would do based on this passage. And then it was interesting because I hadn't noticed until I was looking at it this morning again. Or maybe I had noticed and forgotten. But it's immediately followed by the most quoted verse possibly in the book of Jeremiah. The heart is desperately wicked, deceitful and desperately wicked. Who can understand it? I, Yahweh, search the heart and test the mind to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his deeds. He's not done with the fruit thing. And the person who judged according to your ways, well, there's two basic ones. Trust in man, trust in God. And it's a pretty simple, straightforward thing. But the reason that I went to it in the first place is because I was meditating on John 15. I keep going back to the passage where Jesus says, no longer do I call you servants, I call you friends. But that in context is John 15:4. Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit, and that's the fruit bearing that took me back to Jeremiah 17, unless it abides in the vine, neither can you bear fruit unless you abide in me. And it's that same concept. The abiding is parallel to the drawing in through your roots, the water, the freshness, the refreshment of knowing God and trusting in God and walking with God and meditating on His word. And in Nancy's case, reading those great books on God's attributes and just fixing your mind on things above, not on the earth. And then verse 5, I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit, for apart from me, you can do nothing. And it's like, well, we can clearly do stuff apart from God. It's just that it all amounts to nothing. And so the person who trusts in man is doing things with his life, but it's amounting to nothing because he's apart from Yahweh. And therefore, and apart from him, we can do nothing. And then skipping down to verse 9, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love. This abide thing, dwell in, live in, be at home in. It's like when Jesus says, I go to prepare a place for you. It's a place for you to live. And we are to live our lives with God. He's in us. He's over us. He's around us, under us, above us. But He is in us, with us all the time, but then sometimes we ignore His presence. And when I say us, of course, I mean believers, genuine believers. It's kind of like did you ever read that old booklet, My Heart, Christ's Home? Just a great thing to read every once in a while. I think of it. I haven't gone back and read it for many years, but I'm trying to remember, not Charles Hummel, who wrote that? I forget. But anyway, My Heart, Christ's Home. Just a little booklet, but basically, as it sounds, it's making the place for, in your heart, for Christ to dwell and meeting him daily and, you know, all of those things and how that changes your life. And he says, these things I have spoken to you, verse 11, and I love this. Two components. These things I have spoken to you that my joy may be in you. Secondly, coming right out of that, and that your joy may be full. Not these things I've spoken to you because these are right and true things, and these are the things that bring me glory. All true. He could have said that, and it would have been true. But that's not what he said. He actually makes it about us. I mean, in a way, these things I've spoken to you that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full, because that's what I want. I want your joy to be full. And there are translations that translate it as happiness, and it's just a word that can be translated joy, happiness, delight, any of those things. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. And this is this commandment, which commandments to a lot of people seem burdensome, you know, and it's obviously it's not easy to love everybody, and especially not easy to love everybody as he has loved us, which is like the ultimate. And that's is that sounds like it's raising the bar a little too high. I mean, really, you know, you are infinitely loving. We are finite, so we can't be infinitely loving. Yet that's what we look at when we consider what he has done for us out of his love for us. Then we are to think, small thing for me to make sacrifices for other people, because none of them involve going to a cross and suffering a horrific death and dying for the sins of the whole world, or even for my own sins that I deserve to die for. So love, any act of love that we could ever do is so small in comparison. I met with a friend yesterday, and I have several friends who are in this category, whose wife has dementia, and it's just been excruciating. And one of the things he said, and he really loves Jesus with all of his heart, but he said, you know, when I stand before the Lord, I have one thing I want to ask him, and exactly what he's going to say, why? You know, I mean, that's the problem of evil and suffering, and why? And we don't have, usually we don't know the why. We can see certain reasons. I mean, sometimes it's that we may bear fruit and persevere and become more Christ-like. We know that that's always true in adversity. But that's one of his goals. But why this specific thing, like he was saying, why, you know, why didn't she just quickly die like Michelle Norquist? Or, I know 4 years wasn't quick, but at least Nancy knew who you were. You know, I go, you're right. I mean, I wouldn't trade places. Mm-hmm. You know, not that I have any choice in that anyway. But you just don't know the why. Interestingly, he's read and really enjoyed my books on heaven, but hadn't read any of the ones on suffering. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a reason for that. Because, well, some people don't even want to think about heaven because you got to die to get there, right? So, or somebody that you love has died, and so that's why you're thinking. But, I mean, who wants to think about the problem of evil and suffering? But when it happens to you, now you're thinking about it. But anyway, greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. And now, this is what is the segue to what he's going to say next. Because my commandment is that you love one another as I've loved you. And now I'm going to tell you about this great love. Now, in other places, while we were yet sinners, while we were yet enemies of God, he died for us. And sometimes a man will die for his friend, but who dies for their enemy? You know, so there's that. But that isn't what he says here. And every time he says something different, there's a reason for it. And I think his focus here is on the friends because of what he says. Greater love is no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. And then he says, you are my friends if. And now we have a condition. And usually we're talking about God's unconditional love. There's no conditions at all. And it's almost like, well, you know, there's a lot of conditions in Scripture, like Jeremiah 17. You got to do something. You got to plant yourself beside these waters. You've got to trust in and cultivate trust in Yahweh, your God. You've got to choose not to trust in man and behave the way that you would behave if you're trusting in man. And so Jeremiah 17 is conditional. It may not use the exact terminology of if then, but the if then is directly here. You are my friends if you do what I command you. And at first, that just sounds like, wow. I mean, with a human being, if they said that to you, well, then you just go, well, I don't want to be your friend because I don't want it to be conditioned on me doing what you command me to do. Well, before he's our friend, he's our God who created us, obviously. He's our Redeemer. But you are my friends if you do what I command you. Now, who comes out ahead through our obedience? Is it God who just desperately needs our friendship? You know, he's just would not be complete. You know, he would be so sad and he would be weeping if we didn't. Now, I don't mean that God doesn't have emotions. He does. And I don't mean he doesn't care if we are not his friend. But who's the primary beneficiary of our friendship with God? I mean, obviously, it's us. And that's the thing. I always come back to this because even when he's commanding us to do something, it's in our best interest. It's always in our best interest. So instead of, you know, and I actually have had quite lengthy conversations with people saying, it just really bothers me, this stuff about the glory of God. It just seems so selfish of God that he wants things, you know, for his glory. And I'm not hearing much about our good. They say, oh, actually, whatever is for his glory is for our good. And you're just making a false dichotomy here, a separation. It's like you're thinking the way the world thinks, which is I have a choice. I could either follow God and be obedient and live this drudgery life and maybe someday get rewards in heaven for it. But I'm not going to be happy because the sinners are the ones that are having all the fun. And it is so untrue. It is so utterly false. You're not getting it. So it's like the smart and stupid idea is that the right thing is always the smart thing and the wrong thing is always the stupid thing, which when I used to work in high school and college ministry, I used to camp on that a lot because of all the things that are in Proverbs, I think what resonates most with most young people is not doing a thing because it's right and avoiding something because it's wrong as much as doing a thing because it's smart and not doing a thing because it's stupid. Because smart and stupid, you can have a concept of that even before you have deeply entrenched sense of holiness about right and wrong. And we need both. I mean, we certainly need to be cultivating holiness and young people need to, but just sometimes it's just not enough when they're being tempted with their friends or whatever it is. It's not enough to know that God says this is right. I wish it was enough, and I know I should do this, and I shouldn't do the wrong thing. Well, if you think in terms of Proverbs, you are taking your own life. You are like an ox that is led to the slaughter. No one who touches another man's wife shall go unpunished. The level of consequences alone, even if you didn't want to choose right because it's right and didn't want to avoid wrong because it's wrong, just the level of consequences alone should be enough to persuade you. And the negative consequences of doing the wrong thing, but the positive consequences of doing the right thing. So you've got consequences working for you both ways. So again, whatever is to God's glory is and always to our good. So, greater love is no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. I have revealed to you, I have informed you of my Father's purposes. Now, you could say, he doesn't inform us of everything. It's just like I was saying, well, we don't know all the reasons why he allows, ordains, sends, depending on how Calvinist or Arminian you are, you can use all those words, any of those words, sends trouble on us or allows trouble in our lives, and sometimes very serious trouble and very serious suffering. But even though we don't know all that, think of what he has revealed to us. I mean, think of this book. I mean, sometimes people complain that this book is so big. You know, God has told us stuff. And think of the Gospels, four of them. And think of what percentage, which I don't know offhand, of what's in the New Testament. Certainly, it's dominant, the four Gospels. If you combined, including Acts, everything else together, it would be considerably smaller than the four Gospels combined. But even if you looked at it in the whole of Scripture, throw in the Old Testament as well. The Old Testament is 75% of the whole Bible, but it's still a huge portion for the Gospel. This is just Jesus telling us and the Gospel writers telling us about Jesus. What has been revealed to us is shockingly large. Now, we just don't study it all or remember it all or memorize it all or keep it all in mind, but it is there. And even what he had revealed to his disciples, and we don't even know some of the things he revealed to his disciples, but certainly he taught them, you know, the Old Testament and like the road to Emmaus where Jesus walks those two disciples who we don't even really know, one's called Cleopas, I think, but is the other one named? I don't know, remember. But anyway, and we don't know them. But Jesus walked them through the Old Testament, teaching them about himself before they even realized it was Jesus. And so it's like the stuff, and I have to believe that they weren't the only two he ever did that with, right? I mean, he's with the apostles for 3 years. Surely he walked them through, but we just are not in on. I mean, I wish we were, and one day we will be. But he's saying the servant does not know what his master is doing. This is not like the Muslim envisions his relationship with Allah, which is, you know, the Holy One, but not the tender, loving friend. And this is Jesus, part of the triune God, the Son, who says, I'm not calling you servants anymore. Now, of course, we are still called servants, but that's a way of a Hebraism or, you know, even in the Greek language, but with Hebrew thought, is common to say, this is no longer the case. It's always been the case this way. And now I'm doing something new and different this way. So I say, no longer do I do this. Now I do this. Well, you know, it's like a mother who says to her daughter, no longer do I call you daughter. You are now my friend. Mm-hmm. You know, well, she's still her daughter, right? And sometimes she'll be called her daughter. But we all know the emphasis is on this is a new relationship. And Jesus offers us a new relationship. We've already got, if we know him, we've already got the old one. We are servants of God. We may not be completely obedient servants of God, but we are servants of God. But if we do what he tells us and are obedient servants, we move into the friend zone. You know, now he calls us friends. And we can call him our friend. It's probably a little uneven if Jesus isn't willing to call us friends because we're not obeying him. And then we call him friend. That's not that meaningful. It's kind of like the boy who asks his dad, "Hey, is there anything I can do?" Which would probably be rare. But he asked that, and then dad says, "Yeah, please take out the garbage and clean up your room." And then the kid doesn't take out the garbage or clean up his room, and then comes back, says, "Dad, I just want to please you. What can I do?" I said, "Well, why don't you just start by doing what I already told you to do, right? Because if you really don't even pretend to be this obedient, faithful son, if you're not going to do what I already told you to, don't be asking me for new things to do." And that's the thing where we sometimes are seeking God's will for our lives when we are already disobeying and not doing what he says his will is, which obviously is neither right nor smart. "No longer do I call you servants, for the servant doesn't know what his master is doing." Just that he fills us in. He confides in us. This passage is saying Jesus confides in us. You know, you think of when a servant was told to do something in that culture, did the master go into a long explanation? "Here's the big picture. I have a plan to develop this land, and eventually we'll have a building over here that does this, and then we'll have this over here, and then we'll have servants' quarters for you over here, and they'll be really nice, and all of it, just do it. Just do the thing. That's just do your job. That's master to servant." So we are his servants, but we are also his friends. And the friend gets an explanation. The friend is confided in, welcomed into the inner circle. And that inner circle, by the way, there's three in the inner circle to begin with: Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And there are a number of passages in John, even with the "love one another as I've loved you," where Father, make them one even as we are one. What? I mean, the essential unity of the triune God we are to enter into, and we are to become one with each other as God is one within three himself. I mean, these amazing statements. So you did, right after he says, "All that I've heard from my Father I've made known to you, you did not choose me, but I chose you." And I think sometimes to be reminded of this, I remember one night it just struck me, I think probably in her last few weeks, maybe her last month before she died, one night when we were praying, Nancy, her whole prayer was this: "Father, thank you for choosing me." And I was like, that kind of says it all, but it's not language that we say that often. When did you choose to follow Jesus? You know, well, that's fine, because we do choose. It's the Calvinist Arminian thing again. It's not one instead of another, but clearly, the fundamental thing is that he chose us. "You did not choose me. I chose you, and I appointed you that you should go and bear fruit." And here we are back to fruit. He's not leaving the fruit. And again, it takes me back to Jeremiah 17, but also earlier, fruit is a theme throughout. "And that your fruit should abide." You abide in me, same word, and your fruit shall abide. Have a lasting relationship with me. Give your whole life to it. Never set me aside, never set our relationship aside, and I will guarantee that your fruit will abide, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give to you. These things I command you, so that you will love one another. It's like he wraps up the whole theme, that we would love one another as he has loved us. But to me, I said this, I think, once before in here, sometime after Nancy died, but since she has been with the Lord, and I am the, some people could say, I am the only person in the house. They would allow that Gracie is in the house, and her presence is actually much more significant than to me than most people would expect. Well, that's nice. He has a dog, but he's still coming home to an empty house, and that's why I say, no, it's not an empty house. But it's true, she's not a person. In some ways, she brings things into my life that people don't bring in. But of course, she can't bring into my life everything that people can bring in. But here's the question. Is God a person? Is Jesus a person? And when he... Look at her crossed legs. She's being a lady, Darius. When Jesus says, lo, I'm with you always, what does he mean? I am with you. Well, is he with me when I'm in my house? Is he with us in this room right now? Of course he is. And again, he is in us. And again, he is over us and under us and around us. And he couldn't be more present, except he could be physically present. And he was at one time. But even to the apostles, he was saying, it's better that I go to the Father, because the Holy Spirit, who is omnipresent in ways that Jesus, being incarnate in one single body, was not in that full sense omnipresent, but has returned, even though he's in a resurrection body in heaven. How that works, I don't know. But, lo, I am with you always. So he's always going to be with. Never, Hebrews 13, never, no, never, not by any means will I forsake you. That passage in Hebrews 13 has three negatives in the Greek language in sequence. And I think it may be the only time that that's true, but it's just, I will not by any means forsake you is one translation. Because it just sounds like, I will never forsake you. Well, now when you say it three times, you're really making a point. And the reason, why would he really make a point of saying that? We're prone to forget. Mm-hmm. And so as a parent, why do you say something three times? They're not doing what you want them to do. So, okay, get this. I want you home by fill in the blank. And the reason that you repeat it three times is probably because they haven't always been home when you've said it. You don't have to say it once if they had always obeyed you. And I think when that's said in Hebrews, I don't think you really believe this. And so I'm going to tell you, never, no, never, not by any means will I forsake you. You can count on it. You know, take it to the bank. And I think that this passage, the friendship passage, has probably meant more to me than any other passage, because Jesus, I think, is more a friend to me now. At least I am sensing his friendship, which has always meant a lot to me. I have thought about and talked about the friendship of Jesus, but because I don't have any other human friend in the house, Nancy was my best friend on the human plane. Mm-hmm. And we would often say to each other, you know, you're my second best friend. Jesus is my best friend. And that actually is a great reassurance now. You know, Nancy's with her best friend, and my best friend is still with me. Mm-hmm. And he's the connection between the two of us. But the friendship of Jesus. And would you, if somebody's really your friend, the idea of turning your back on them and not trusting them is just unthinkable. And when your friend has scars in his hands and feet because of his love for you and what he did for you, it's all the more unthinkable. And I do think it's true, because I have grandkids the age of some of your kids, and maybe all of your kids, about, you know, with the span of my grandkids. Well, not your oldest ones, but I just think of how important in their life the friendship of Jesus could be. We obviously talk about him as Lord, and rightly so. I mean, he's spoken of as Lord much more often than he's spoken of as friend, right? But when he makes that point, I just think it's a basis for saying, let's emphasize the friendship of Jesus. And even great thing for a family to talk about. So here's this passage. In what way is Jesus your friend? In what way are you a friend of Jesus? And how does that show itself in your life? And for me, when I'm driving and I'm talking aloud to him, and when I'm sitting and I'm talking aloud to him, and I've said this before, sometimes I pray, sometimes I set up a chair, like in the chair in Safely Home, and just imagine that he's sitting there, because he did used to sit in chairs. They reclined more often than they sat in chairs, but you know, he sat in them and he made them. He was a carpenter. It's no stretch at all. It's not like, oh man, that's, some people think anytime you imagine Jesus, it's idolatry and it's a violation of the second commandment. No. When it's Jesus, now, if you were envisioning the Father and even the Spirit, who are not embodied, like happens in the shack, for instance, you could say, I'm not sure I'm going there. Well, you envision Jesus in a body. He had a body and will have a body forever. So we don't know what the body looked like. So there's no heresy in thinking of Jesus as having a body, because the heresy is thinking of Jesus as not having had a body. Or even now not having a body, because he ascended in his resurrection body. But how is he your friend? How is he my friend? And it's, his friendship is just more precious to me than I can possibly express.